From WXXI News, this is the Summer of Food on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Charleston, South Carolina in 2010. A young chef named Sean Brock opened a restaurant there called Husk, which celebrated purely Southern ingredients. Before we get too far into the story, keep in mind it's always dangerous to oversimplify a cause and effect. But there's no denying that 8 years ago, the food scene in Charleston was different. Today, it's a magnet for world travelers who seek out the best in dining. And maybe it took a restaurant like Husk to serve as a kind of domino, starting a chain reaction that raised quality and excitement. Sid Evans, writing for Travel and Leisure magazine, examined how this smaller city became a world-class culinary capital. He writes, quote, Husk would pave the way for an explosion of new restaurants and bars that have transformed the city. Charleston is an international food destination now, like Paris or San Sebastian, Spain. Eating is a sport there, a topic of conversation from the streets south of Broad to the suburbs of Mount Pleasant. But something bigger than food is now reshaping Charleston. There is more traffic and there is also more energy. Charleston is home to more than 250 tech companies now. Hip shops are opening. What not so long ago was a sleepy little town in the low country is becoming a city that never sleeps, end quote. Today marks the final conversation in our Summer of Food series on Connections, and so we wanted to know, what would it take for Rochester to become the next Charleston? Maybe you have this idea that you have to be New York City or Chicago to become an international food destination, but Charleston's smaller than Rochester. Just looking at media market size, Rochester ranks 76th, Charleston 94th. Per capita, no city in the country has the quality of restaurants that Charleston has, so why not here? Well, my guests this hour are two of the top chefs in our city. Art Rogers is the chef and owner of Lento and the only James Beard-nominated chef in Rochester history. Nice to see you back here. Thanks for being here, Art.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
And Derek DePorter is the chef and co-owner of Unter Beer Garden. Nice to have you here, Derek. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, so.
And you opened Unter in just less than a year ago. In fact, just last winter, right?
Mid-February we opened up.
And Unter Beer Garden is in the place where Victoire used to be.
Sure is.
So Unter means under?
Under, below. I'm not German, but that's what the kind of the thought process was behind that name, yeah, because we're below street level.
And Derek's background took him to a number of places, not the least of which is the Revelry in Rochester. Trained down in Orlando. Where did you do some work training there?
I worked at Emeril Lagasse, the godfather of American cuisine and being a celebrity chef, one of the first. So it's pretty intense down there for 3 years and came back to Rochester.
Well, here both of you are now on a scene that I guess I want to ask you first, right out of the gate here, how you view the culinary scene. Art Rogers, Lento opened, if I remember correctly, 2007. So a decade plus later, I think one of the reasons that you're the only James Beard-nominated chef in the city's history is because you were the first to really kind of overtly highlight the connection to local farms, and to the extent that some might kind of try to capitalize it on or kind of commodify that relationship, you did it authentically. Your peers, I think, noticed how valuable that is. And the quality of what you've been doing for more than 10 years is outstanding. And so I'm curious to know 10 years plus later, how you viewed the scene. How do we rank? How satisfied are you with the quality? How do you see it?
It's definitely way better than it was 10 years ago and way better than when I graduated from high school in 1996. I think we still have a way to go. Thinking about Charleston and with your intro there, I'm just wondering what came first, the tech companies and the chic shops or the restaurants. I'm thinking that you need to get that infrastructure in first and make it a desirable place to visit. And then when the people come, whether they're living down here or visiting, the restaurant scene will follow. I could be wrong about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might be one of the reasons Charleston has been such a success.
Yeah, so there's an economic motivator, an economic factor that has fresh up-and-coming industry of some kind, for them tech, that you think helps spark interest in what we do in our daily lives, restaurants, et cetera.
Yeah, maybe. You have all those people living down there because of the tech jobs, and they were demanding, you know, high-end or at least unique type of dining experience, and the restaurants filled that gap, and now it's a world-class scene.
Derek, how do you view the scene in Rochester right now?
It's definitely come a long ways since when I moved back. I moved back in 2008. It's definitely grown for the best. I think it's going to continue to grow. Now, being a restaurateur and being in Center City, East End, you know, we're so excited for what the future holds for downtown with the development of the Inner Loop. Hopefully, it's not just a pile of rocks much longer. But I think we're getting there, definitely getting there.
You know, Art, you raise an important point that a city like Rochester, amid the small-sized city anywhere in the world, can't just, well, maybe it can, but it's hard to just pop up with the world's best cocktail scene, the world's best restaurant scene, without an influx of jobs, new jobs, steady industry. And you're right, Charleston's had that with tech. But there's also lots of cities with hot industry, hot jobs, and really kind of junky restaurant scenes,
yeah.
Really mediocre food, the Ciscos of the world dominating all across these otherwise hot cities. And so let me ask you both, what do you think it is that is a spark on the culinary side? Is it one chef doing things differently? Is it one particular restaurant? Does it take more than that? What do you think is the spark that starts to move the needle on the culinary side? Because there's a lot of bad dining out there, isn't there?
For sure. I think you are on the right trail saying, like, it takes that one spark, that one chef to get everybody fired up. You know, we've seen it a little bit in this community in Rochester, I think. You know, when the Rev opened, a lot of restaurants opened at the same time. And we all started becoming friends. Like, when I moved back to Rochester, some of the big old players in the game, the old chefs that have been around the block a while, they didn't really play nice with others. They did their own thing, and that's what they wanted to do, which is cool, and it's old school, and I get it. But now this new generation of younger chefs, we talk all the time. You know, we go to each other's restaurants. We bounce ideas off of people. So I think that camaraderie pushes people more to start doing more out-of-the-box items on their menus and doing different cuisine and looking at more farm to table. And I think it helps push everybody.
That's a very interesting observation. And it's one that, this sounds really self-serving and ridiculous, but I'll just observe, it's one of the themes that came out in my ancient history book that came out in 2011. And so that shows up in the wine scene, that shows up in the cocktail scene. It probably shows up in the coffee scene, any individual niche of food, drink, et cetera. There is this idea that, do we bunker in and do it ourselves and we are competitors and we don't sort of try to lift other boats, or are we willing to talk and share ideas and see success breed more success? So what you seem to be observing is right now on the scene, it's more collaborative than it was.
I think you see a lot of that. You know, some of my best friends out there are chefs at different restaurants, and we all talk, and we do events. Like when I went to Savor Rochester, before Jazz Fest, like I bumped into so many old faces I haven't seen in a while and got to, you know, like we were friends on Instagram and we like each other's stuff, but we never met each other. And then we get to talking and it's great. And we bounce ideas off of each other and we all want to do dinners together. And there's a lot of influence there from one another, I think, that we can find, which is going to push the culinary scene for sure.
How do you see that, Art?
I agree. That's definitely a plus with the Rochester food scene. We all get along, we all talk, we all can bounce ideas, and we do lots of dinners and charity events and things like that together. I really can't think of any chefs or restaurateurs that are sort of old school and just see you as a competitor and wouldn't let you borrow a cup of sugar.
Was it more curmudgeonly when you opened Lento?
Nah, I don't think so. I mean, I've always gotten along, even with the casual restaurants in the Village Gate. We've, you know, like I said, gone over to borrow an eggplant or borrow an avocado from Selena's. Like, we've all, I don't think it matters even the type of restaurant. It's a really healthy relationship I think we have here, which is great. The other way around, I think, would be stressful and, you know, definitely not make us all rise up.
Well, here's an email from a listener named Andrew, Adam, who says that the one word that lifts up great restaurants is creativity.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Whether our guests, is that a word that would come to mind first or high on the list for you for when you think about what makes something great?
I think so. I'm sure art does the same thing. It's like when we try to write menus, we try to be creative and think outside the box and check out. I'm sure you're just like me, you have a million cookbooks, and I like to get ideas from them and take inspiration from them using a different ingredient or something like that. So you got to be a creative. You got to keep people fresh. People are kind of tired of eating chicken Marcella and chicken parm, I think.
I don't know, man. Like, and I want to believe that's true.
I'm going to disagree.
See, I want to believe
that. All right, well, I tell myself that at least.
Yeah. Right, me too. I definitely do.
I want to believe that's right, you know, because, you know, Art, I think on a past program, you remarked that there's almost this requirement that you've got a burger or something like it on the menu that's a safety valve. And that still exists. That need still exists for your dining clientele?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, you want to be creative, but when I first opened, I used to see Jerry Verassi, the old chef of Tuvine, the original chef owner there, at the public market at 5 in the morning. And I'd be like, man, I put on this like soft shell crab appetizer. We used to sell a ton of these in Maine. Like, nobody's ordering it. And he's like, this is a meat and potatoes town. It's a meat and potatoes town. I had no idea what he was talking about. I'm like, what is a meat and potatoes town? But now I get it. You need to have, you can be creative, but you need to have a blend of familiar with your creative in order to draw in, I think, more of a crowd to your restaurant.
I love asking you this question because every year it varies slightly, but it's fascinating to me what high-end chefs, how they answer this. What's one thing that you love putting on the menu or would love to put on more if people would buy it?
Foie gras all day.
Foie gras? People don't touch it?
People will touch it and you'll sell it, but it'll never sell like you want it to. I mean, it will sell, but it costs a lot of money and it's a small niche.
Okay. Art?
I would say just to be more, I'm gonna be more general on this one. Just something that is normal but unfamiliar. Like right now we have a red drum on, which is a fish wild caught in North Carolina, very similar to mahi mahi. No one will order it. I've briefed the wait staff, they've tasted it, it's not weird. People don't know what it is and they are passing it over. And I wish people would just be like, oh, a different kind of fish that isn't salmon or snapper. I'm gonna try it. And they would like it. But it's a challenge to put anything like red drum that's unfamiliar, and get people to try it, you know, and the price point might have something to do with that too. They'd be like, ooh, $28. Like, what if I don't like it? I'm gonna order the burger.
See, and this is the chicken and the egg question. So we did it with the economy, jobs and hot restaurants in a city. When it comes to culturally changing the mindset of the dining public at large, do you have to have a dining public that's more experimental and sort of exploratory, and then you can offer that? Or do you have to continue to put that on the menu and slowly over time they start gravitating toward it?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, you definitely need it's education 100%. Like, you never want to have the restaurant, well, maybe some people do, but you don't want to be pretentious. You want to be approachable. You don't want your staff to come off as, I know this and you don't. But we want our staff to educate. That's the number one thing that I've always stood behind. I need to educate my staff as much as I can so they can educate the customer. That way we can hopefully sell the red drums and the things like that. But unless you have somebody backing it and educating, it makes it tough. I don't know. I think it's a little bit of both of what you said.
Yeah, and is there a willingness at times to say to a customer, "All right, you've never heard a red drum. Can you sample it? I mean, can you try to put it in front of people, even in a small amount?"
Maybe. I mean, yeah, that's not quite how it works.
Why not?
Well, because all these things are portioned, just like any business. Yeah. Everything is all set, and it's all, you know, boring restaurant math, but you could serve it as an appetizer and, you know, figure out a creative way to do the red drum in a, you know, more inexpensive form where people are like, oh, like a $9 red drum. I don't want to say like a cake because you'd sort of lose it in that, but you could think of something to do and then people would be like, you know, I can give this a try. And then they'd be like, oh, this is good. So yes,
I think a lot of it too plays with how you label something. For instance, I did fried lamb tongue at Unta, and it sold way better than I ever could have predicted because we didn't tell people it was lamb tongue. We just called it lamb fries. And they would get it, and they'd be like, this is delicious. And I'd be like, yeah, it's lamb meat. And they'd be like, where's it from? And then you say, it's the tongue. And they'd be like, awesome. And then they come back. People ask for them all the time. Now that's not on the menu.
But you tell them after the fact.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're a brave, brave man.
It's lamb.
You wouldn't do it that way, Art? Because you put something like sweetbreads on. A lot of people do not understand what a sweetbread is.
I haven't served sweetbreads. We do have head cheese on right now. And I say it's... When I say head cheese, no one will touch it. If I label it as pork head terrain, it sells okay.
Pork head terrain.
Right.
But head cheese, which is a more traditional restaurant name for it, doesn't go at all.
No. People don't like the sound of that.
Okay, so this is a city that's not willing yet to order head cheese. That's an important marker for where Rochester is. And if that sounds elitist or snob, it's just an observation because I guarantee you in Charleston you could put head cheese on the menu and it would sell.
For sure. Yeah, I'd buy it.
Okay, and so if you're just joining us, we're having a conversation about how food culture changes and what it might take to make Rochester an international destination in a way that some smaller cities, we're looking at Charleston, South Carolina, but Portland, Maine, really? Where did you work before Rochester?
I worked in Rockland, Maine, which is about an hour and a half north of there, but I spent a lot of time in Portland, Maine. And just like Rochester, Portland always had a really great food scene, but now it's like Charleston. It's an amazing food scene. You see tons of James Beard nominations and winners coming out of Portland.
Absolutely.
Really awesome.
Are you envious of that? Of that
sure.
kind of a scene and a culture?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, you know, I'd love my restaurant to be packed full every night with people eating head cheese and, you know, what have you. But, you know, we've, over 11 years, figured out how to make it work, and I haven't had to compromise. And I mean, I don't feel, yeah, I feel envious, but I don't feel like regretful. Like
no.
I have to serve chicken marsala and fettuccine alfredo, but I mean, I get to flex.
Do you
my
serve fettuccine alfredo?
No,
I didn't think so.
But I get to flex my culinary muscle, maybe not as much as I would like, but that's just because it's. It can't be too unfamiliar. It can't be too.
And I think the argument that I'm trying to make, whether I'm being successful or not, I don't know, is that over time, if you are able to be 10% experimental and 90% familiar, maybe after 10 years, it's 40-60. And after another 10 years, it's
for sure
60-40. And that's the way it goes. You don't flip it overnight unless something really remarkable happens. And I think you can look at Charleston and say, well, Sean Brock's restaurant caught fire and a lot of other people started doing similar things. Maybe. But you're right. The tech industry went there. 250 tech startups are there. You have a historic location. You have historic infrastructure. You're on the ocean.
Yeah.
You're in a warmer climate. They have a little bit more on the advantage side. So maybe in less than a decade, they could flip the switch. I don't know that it could happen in less than a decade here.
That city's amazing. I mean,
you've been there.
I've been there a handful of times. It's really cool. I mean, you're on a little peninsula. There's three main roads that all run up and down the peninsula, and there's just so much going on. Storefronts. There's this one street. I think it's King Street. On Sundays, they shut down King Street, and it's just like Park Ave Fest down King Street. You know, and there's food vendors, and all the stores are doing stuff. And there's such a large group of industry people there. So it's like when I went down there and visited, I'm hanging out with industry people. Mm-hmm. We go out to a bar late night and you're talking to everybody and their brother that works at the coolest restaurants. And it's just really cool. I don't know if maybe because they're on a peninsula and they're just like forced to be that tight and that close. And Rochester, we have kind of different locations. You know, you got Noda, you got the East End, you got Park Ave, everything's kind of spread out,
yeah.
So maybe it's a little tougher on that aspect to think that we can be like Charleston, even though we're small like Charleston, we're spread out more, I guess.
It's a good observation. Just geographically, there may be advantages as well. And here's an email from CT who says, Evan, I grew up eating head cheese. Grandma made it, and I loved it. There you go. But CT had it from childhood.
Yeah.
That's an advantage. Adults walk right into a high-end restaurant, they're willing to spend money, but they see head cheese, they may not be willing to do it. And what Art's telling us is generally they're not.
And everyone likes it, too. I think they just don't like the idea of eating pig head for some reason. I mean, it's not... It doesn't taste weird. It's not
offensive.
Then
the word cheese. Is there any cheese in there?
No, there's no cheese
in
there.
Well, then, you know, maybe it's a branding problem.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, that's why we call it pork head terrine. And it still doesn't really sell, but it sells a lot better than when we call it head cheese. So, we've had to figure out how to market it a little differently.
I want to ask our listeners where their dining destinations are in Rochester and maybe around the country. If you had a 3-day weekend to go eat anywhere you wanted to, 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And I want to ask both Art Rogers from Lento and Derek DePorter from Unterbiergarten what you want the dining public to do. And this isn't a lecture to the dining public. I mean, but I do want to know from your perspective, Art, if you're saying, yeah, Portland, Maine makes me envious to see that kind of a culture. Charleston, South Carolina makes me envious to see that kind of a culture that dives into new things or new ideas or is maybe a little bit more sophisticated at understanding what certain things are and comparing them. I'd love to know what you would love the dining public to do. Is it as simple, Derek, as being more adventurous? I mean, what do you want to see your customers do?
I think it's really that easy. Just be more adventurous, you know? Sure, you know, Cheesecake Factory, they do something great and they have millions of locations, but anybody can go there and get that salad and cheeseburger.
They're not doing anything great.
Well, I'm being nice, but I'm saying you can support your small local restaurants, you know, the Lentos, the Untas, those kind of places like that, and you're going to experience something that's going to be fresh, local, different, you know, and than the same old, same old.
All right, so what your play is more about, you know, maybe think about local instead of chain.
Yeah.
Okay, and to put another point on the Cheesecake Factory, the one thing I remember most, even 10 years ago, when one opened where my parents are, how many people say, I went to Cheesecake Factory and it was amazing. The portions were huge.
Gigantic, yeah.
It was not a commentary on the cuisine. It was, did you see the size of that, whatever. That's what it was. I don't think that's good for the culture, but...
Definitely not.
But man, their decor is something else. I've never done drugs, but I have gone to a Cheesecake Factory. Art, what do you want customers to do?
I actually agree with what Derek just said. I was going to say the same thing, like stop eating at chain restaurants, try the independent restaurant, you know, at whatever level. You know, the Village Gate, I think, is a good area where you could try a bunch of different styles of independent restaurants, all completely different from one another. You know, go to Salinas instead of going to Taco Bell or I'm sure Chipotle. You know, they do a better job, and you're supporting your neighbors and, you know, people that live in your community and not huge corporations, and it's a little more creative and tasty. And I do think it is just simple as people just wanting to just try something different. It's not going to kill you. You know, like everyone's so fussy.
if you don't get the burger, you will survive the meal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe not.
Or you can give us a terrible review on Yelp about the head cheese.
All right. Let me get Jack in Geneva, who also wants to ask, you know, about this idea of sampling. Go ahead, Jack.
Well, thank you. I've been listening to this, and they put it on the menu, but and I know this is not inexpensive to do, but could you, when you do this, or even anticipation of doing it, put out a very small plate of the different things that you want to put out, like the head cheese, which I've heard about, and the foie gras, and so on and so forth, and let people sample it for free, or at least no cost to them, and see if, you know, what the response is. I have a great success with that when I was in the school lunch program. And these, you're talking with kids who are so randomable that they won't stray from anything that they don't recognize. So I just like to hear what they would have to say about it, or even if they have tried it. Thank you. I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, Jack. Thanks. Derek DePorter.
Yeah, well, you can kind of do that and can't kind of do that. Like Art kind of mentioned, you know, kitchen math. But anytime we have people come in that, not even people that I know, but people that come in first time, they are intriguing with the server. They're talking to my manager. I can tell that they're interested. You know, we send them out stuff. We welcome them with something. And that's the perfect opportunity for us to send you something like a foie gras or a head cheese or something that you may not be familiar with and just a little bite of it. And that's usually free and on the house. And it just welcomes in the guests that way. So it can be done to a certain extent. And
okay, well, maybe our listeners are pushing some ideas into your brains. Art, you want to respond to Jack as well? Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, we have a meeting every afternoon before we open, and we talk to the servers about things like that. And the servers will try the food, and if they're really excited about something, you can see something that may have been a little bit of a harder sell a lot better because they feel confident standing behind it. So I guess it's kind of like giving a sample. The third party, someone else has tried it, can speak right for it. And sure, you can send those things out to your regulars, but usually your regulars are some of your better, more adventurous diners anyway that would appreciate sort of less common things, more unique things.
Brian Van Etten, your colleague who runs the Playhouse and does a great job over there, writes to us and says, I went to Charleston and Husk in particular, and he says, while I liked it, I was more impressed with the casual food of the city and the ambiance of the area. Old buildings with so much history, the ocean, these things and more made eating every meal romantic and somehow more flavorful. So maybe they've got a geographic advantage. You know, that exists. Yeah. Portland, Maine, you know, has got some romantic ideas there. But Derek, Brian's saying the casual food too. And that's probably important too. If you want to have a great food scene, you need the high end. Mm-hmm. But you need the entire food culture, I think, to be pretty thoughtful.
And it for sure. Like, yeah, that's what there's a restaurant down there called Hominy Grill. And they crush it at brunch and breakfast. And they have like a line out the door. And I've been there and it's good. But yeah, I mean, you have to have that approachable. And you have to definitely have a little bit for everybody, which I think this Rochester has. Like, we have different cuisine that's all smashed around. Like, I never thought I would be doing German cuisine, you know, but you know, down the street, right around the corner, there's Italian at Bronca at Midtown, or down the Lento for, you know, some farm to table food, and there's sushi down the street. There's just so much going on around Rochester that I think you still have that variety.
Okay. Are you pretty happy with that scene too as well, Art? Do you think that the scene's becoming more thoughtful at all levels of dining?
Yeah, I think it is. It's getting better. But I agree with Brian. You know, a lot of times when you travel to a different city, especially for like lunch, you'll seek out, you know, that city's famous casual lunch spot, not something so high end, you know, what has a lot of hype and is inexpensive and good to eat. So I could see how he could see that in Charleston too, because when I travel, I like to seek out, you know, usually it's those older places that have been around there for forever and serving casual fare.
Absolutely. Andy in Lima says he grew up in Asia and he ate exotic things in Asia. He likes chicken marsala and fettuccine Alfredo too, along with the exotic foods. He says Art was dissing those simpler foods. Don't make those simple foods seem less than.
Okay. Sorry. I like chicken marsala and fettuccine Alfredo too, but I'm probably not going to order it at a restaurant.
I'm with you there, especially if it's simply made, you know, sort of at home. I do like to order what I know I can't make or don't make very often.
That's the point of going out.
Yeah, right?
I want to go down to Geneva. Vinny Alapertis on the phone, one of the really awesome winemakers in the region, and it's nice always to hear the Alapertis. How are you, Vinny?
Hey, Evan. Wow, that was quick.
Yeah, well,
I'm listening in. It's a fascinating discussion. And I just wanted to type in to say, you know, you guys shouldn't torture yourselves about Rochester and not being Portland or Charleston. We can't forget you have one of the great wine growing regions in your backyard. You know, I think that's an opportunity that still hasn't been realized. So I'd just like to hear your take on that.
I appreciate that, Vinny. I think it's a very good point. And, you know, this is part of that debate about whether United States or so-called New World wine growing regions will ever be like Old World wine growing regions. For example, if you go to Chablis in France and you go to a restaurant in Chablis, you can order a Chablis, a Grand Cru, or a Chablis Premier Cru or a Village, but it's all Chablis. You know, and that's like that in a lot of different regions here. Here you get a few Finger Lakes wines on the list usually, and some places not at all. Derek, how do you feel about that?
I love the Finger Lakes. I grew up out that way, so the Finger Lakes wine scene is very important to me, and you know, it's a little tougher when I have a beer garden, but we still try to have an elevated wine list, and we always try to have some Finger Lakes representation there. But I think, you know, you've seen definitely a surge with that lately. You know, FLX Table, they've gotten a lot of press and publicity, and they definitely have helped out with that down in Geneva. You know, but then, I don't know, people always want to see Finger Lakes wine up here. When they come to a restaurant, they want to see New York wine. But people still like their big California cabs and all that stuff too.
Yeah, no, but I'm glad to hear that the diners are asking for
local wines.
That's good. It's probably more than they did 10 years ago. What do you think, Art? Are they more in tune with asking for local?
Yeah, more than 10 years ago. We could probably spend a whole hour talking about the Finger Lakes compared to the other wines in Rochester. But I think it sort of ties into what we were saying before. We serve tons of Finger Lake wines at Lento. I'm a huge fan. A huge fan of your book too, Evan.
Oh, gosh. See, now it all sounds really self-serving here. A couple more listener comments. I've got a long list of emails here. Susanna writes to us on Facebook and says, the next Charleston, South Carolina, why in the world would Rochester want to be anything but Rochester? We need to be the best version of ourselves first. Susanna, I think that's a semantic point. I think there's nothing wrong with making that point. Yeah. What I'm making as the host is the point that says, if you want to actually become a destination city where people will literally pack up and go for a 3-day weekend to your city just for the food, which Rochester currently is not, you can do it. You don't have to be a huge city. It has happened in Europe. San Sebastian's 250,000 people. It's a little bit bigger than Rochester. That is on par with Paris as a food scene. I was just there in March. In the United States, it's Charleston, which is smaller by almost 20 market sizes than Rochester. And people literally will travel there for a weekend. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying we should be exactly that. It's asking the question, what are the ingredients that could make Rochester on its own a destination in the same way that some of these other mid to small size are? And that's why we asked Art Rogers from Lento, Derek DePorter from Unter Biergarten to join the conversation and help us see that. When we come back from our only break of the hour, Gretchen in Rochester wants us to address the 800-pound gorilla in the room. We're going to see if our chefs can figure out what that is.
Oh, boy.
And we're going to talk about that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, police accountability. What is the state in Rochester? Well, Police Chief Mike Simonelli says two of his officers roughed up a citizen for no good reason. And now we're going to have a conversation about the latest efforts in developing new police accountability methods. Then in our second hour, the success of the film Crazy Rich Asians. What it tells us about this cultural moment. Talk with you Friday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I just want to mention, you just heard Vinny Alaperti calling from Geneva. He's a winemaker and co-owner at Billsboro on Seneca Lake and has been making wine at Atwater for many years, which is on your list at Lento, that's right?
Yeah, we pour their sparkling rosé. Excellent wine.
I don't know that Vinny has made a wine that I didn't think is excellent, so I'm a big fan. Vinny, thanks for the phone call there. So Gretchen in Rochester wants to mention the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and Derek and Art were able to discern that Gretchen was talking about the garbage plate. She writes that the Rochester food scene is known for the garbage plate. We have to get rid of that dish as the first thing people think of when they think of Rochester food. Now, a year ago on this program, interestingly enough, as part of our Summer of Food, we asked, what is our regional food identity? So we did Finger Lakes and we did Rochester. And Rochester, the panelists and the chefs, and we took a wide sample, kind of agreed that yes, the garbage plate is part of the food identity for good or for ill. But there's a number of things tied to that. First of all, a lot of people had some really good things to say about that. And even Art, I think you guys put a version of the garbage plate on the Lento menu after that conversation.
Yeah, we did. It can be done well. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it as is now, except for the name. Like, you don't want the Rochester signature dish associated with garbage. Like, that is the last thing that you want any sort of food to be called, I think.
But the idea of mashing up a bunch of things and as you guys did, would you call it the local plate, if I remember?
Yeah, something like that.
It was
right?
Great.
Yeah,
it was really,
you know,
great.
We just used all good local, you know, sustainable things and did our version of it, and people loved it. It was a huge success. So, yeah, I really don't think there's anything wrong with the dish per se.
It's the word garbage.
It's the word garbage that is, it just connotates so much bad things.
Okay, Derek, how do you feel about it?
I mean, I love garbage plates. I think it's definitely, for better or worse, it's our identity for this city. I mean, I went to a Rochester Red Wings game the other day for plate night, and it was incredible. I've never seen so many people in one place for a Red Wings game. And I don't think they were all there for the baseball, you know? So we've done it at UNTA on worst night. We do worst special night on Wednesdays. We've played around with it. We kind of do a little German take with a currywurst, which is basically fried hot dog on French fries with curry tomato sauce. So it's kind of like a sloppy garbage plate. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with them.
Okay. All right. Well, Gretchen, thank you for the sentiments and the thought. And I encourage you always check out Summer of Food, which is tagged on our podcasted section of the website. So it's wxxinews.org/connections. Summer of Food, which we've done the last several summers, a bunch of different conversations on the scene. And that one, we took the garbage plate as part of the identity for a full hour, and it was great. That was a great conversation last year. Thank you for that. Let me get Bonnie in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. I actually personally support local, almost local everything, but local restaurants the way you've been describing them. But I wanted to see what a comment your guest might make on something in Rochester. The Morton's restaurant, which is, I think it's kind of a chain restaurant, but it's kind of an upscale steakhouse.
It is, that's right.
At the Hyatt. And I use the bus and I walk by there, and, you know, it's pretty obvious that inside it's pretty fancy and everything. But something I've noticed, before they did that piece, the old, let's just call it the old Hyatt, you know, like a lot of old hotels, they actually had some, often had some pretty good food. And one of the places, one of the times a day I always find was interesting, not as quite as expensive, was lunchtimes. So occasionally, not a lot, I'd go in there for lunch when I happened to be in that area. And they had, you know, pretty good food because it was part of their quality of their food they had at the dinner meal and all that. Not the same menu, maybe. But I did that the other day, and what they've done is, and I think this is due to Morton's being there, the bar area, they have this sign up that says something about street grill food or something, whatever the heck that is. And but it's a very plain menu. And then they have almost nothing for lunch. I looked over to see, you know, thinking I'd see another kind of more hotel, like I was describing, lunch menu, and it's not there. I mean, it's there, but it's like ridiculous. It's like, you know, like going to the corner chain store or something. It's really bad. And I just want, my thinking about this is, I just wonder if the, because they have Morton's there, which is, you know, the real most, I think it's all dinner, and they figure they don't have to do much otherwise.
Guys, any thoughts on that? Interesting. Morton's, by the way, she's right. I think it's a chain, a high-end, yeah, sort of a steakhouse chain. It might be, I don't know if it's the most expensive restaurant in the city. It's probably up there with some of its steaks.
It's, you got to be either that or Char.
Yeah.
Tornadoes.
What do you think, Derek?
Well, that's right around the corner from where I'm at, and I can tell you, and Art and I were talking about this earlier, lunch in general in Rochester is a very difficult shift. I don't think I've ever met any restaurateur or chef that's like, yeah, lunch, we crush it. It's really tough. We try to figure it out every day. So it's like, I don't know. It's a tough service for me to answer that one.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know about lunch either. I know just of the restaurants, and we're not open for lunch, but the Gatehouse seems to do a pretty good lunch when I walk down there. They seem to be busy, but without talking to the owners there, I don't know exactly how busy it is. And Selena's across the way. You know, their deck is full. They seem to have people sitting down and eating lunch.
But would you say that generally we're not really a lunch out city?
It doesn't seem that way.
It doesn't seem that way either. I could be wrong. I don't know. But
I mean, yeah. I'm right down there where all the businesses are, and I don't know if these people all brown bag it, but I don't know. We haven't figured it out, and I've talked to a lot of the neighbors, and they're all scratching their heads too. So.
Unter Beer Garden is open for lunch?
We are open for lunch and brunch and dinner.
Okay. that's all right. You can mention it. That's, you know, you're here. Let people know. Keith and Victor next on the phone. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, real quick, this is interesting. Food in Rochester, a lot of different tastes, a lot of good food.
Where are you calling from, Charleston? I mean, I don't know if you've got no cell tower there. I'm going to sum up what Keith was, I think he was intending to talk about. He wants to see a competition where chefs create a three-course meal under a certain number of calories. So we kind of talked about how the Cheesecake Factory, people walk out of there going, boy, the portions are huge. And the calorie counts on American menus have exploded over the years. I do think this idea of putting calorie counts on certain menus has actually regulated that a little bit. But do you think about that? I mean, Derek, how much do you think about wanting to satisfy customers but wanting them to have a chance to order multiple parts of the menu, not be overloaded? I mean, how do you, but then some say, well, this should have been more.
It's definitely a fine line to walk. You definitely want people to not get filled up on a salad. So at least that's my goal. We definitely try to, we want them to eat more than just an appetizer and an entree. We want them to get dessert. We want them to have a couple drinks. But you don't want to feel like they're getting gypped off and not getting enough food. So, I don't know. It's a fine line to walk.
Okay. Art?
Yeah, we try and keep our portions, you know, medium size, not tiny. Like you said, you want people to be like, this is a huge ripoff. But you also definitely don't want to be like the Cheesecake Factory, which I've never eaten at, but I take your point with, you know, most of these chains have humongous portions. But I don't think about calories when I'm putting my menu together. I think when people go out to eat, they don't really want to think about that. Maybe at a chain where they're listing the calories like during the day if you're getting a sandwich or something. But I think one of the reasons people go out is because we have those, you know, restaurant fryers and we use lots of butter and cream and things like that. And, you know, we have vegan options. So for somebody who's is thinking about that, they would rightfully assume that the vegan choices are going to have much less calories than, you know, the steak with creamed corn or something like that.
Here's Roger writing into the program saying, Evan, too many Rochester restaurants use excessive salt, even after we tell them that we prefer low salt. I would like to know if chefs that have a policy against that.
I love salt.
You're not helping Roger.
I know. I'm sorry, Roger. I mean, that's another fine line. You don't want over-seasoned food, but salt enhances flavor. You got to have salt in your food. And if there's dietary restrictions, usually that's where it falls onto the server to note it to the kitchen, and we aim to please.
Right. And we do, you know, you make a batch of soup ahead of time. It's usually seasoned. So there are certain things where you can't take the salt out, but there are certain things that get seasoned to order. So like you said, if the customer is on a low salt diet or just wants to avoid it, they just have to tell their server that, and we can accommodate that. But there's nothing worse than getting a beautiful meal at a really nice restaurant and you take that first bite and you're like, oh my God, this doesn't taste like anything because they didn't use any salt. And then you have to season your food to order. That's definitely a pet peeve of mine. Like, the food should be seasoned.
By the way, if you were with a group of people going out, because Art's got all this free time. He has no kids. He doesn't work Art's got a lot of things going on. But if you're with a group of people going out and they tell you, oh, by the way, we're going to Cheesecake tonight. Are you going to go? Would you go out to eat a Cheesecake Factory?
Yeah. I'm not gonna be a jerk.
I thought maybe you would.
No, I mean, anyone that knows me would probably not invite me to go out.
That's a good point.
If
they know Art Rogers
so
is in the
group, like a strange, like my brother-in-law's in town and has taken a whole group out and we're going to go to the Cheesecake Factory, yeah, I would go.
Would you maybe gently persuade them? You know, there's other options.
No, that's not right. That's not my style.
Derek, are you going to Cheesecake if you get invited?
I have been there before. But I have a kid, you know, she's 3 years old, and it's just a quick, easy one. But, yeah, I guess I would go to Cheesecake.
I've been there. I ordered off the Skinnylicious menu. It's not that skinny.
Do you get the Skinny Girl Martini?
I have not gotten the Skinny Girl Martini. I have not. We got a few minutes left, so let me ask them the question that's been on my mind, because we started the program talking about the fact that, you know, Rochester cannot use its size as an excuse not to be a great culinary city, that there are smaller cities in the world that are literally international magnets for people who love great food. Charleston, South Carolina, San Sebastian, Spain. I mean, really, Portland, Maine is there and getting there. So we could be there. If you guys had a three-day weekend, someone said, you're free. Go eat whatever city you want that you're most interested in. Where are you going, Derek?
Oh, boy. Are we strictly in the United States or kind of anywhere?
Well, why don't you do one here and one abroad?
I went to San Francisco a couple years ago for my birthday, and I would probably want to go to the West Coast again. I don't know really where in California, but maybe somewhere in Napa, or I don't know. San Francisco is pretty cool, and the food scene there is pretty amazing. Or Charleston.
Internationally?
Internationally, I would definitely want to go to, like, Paris or France, or maybe Italy. I don't know. I'll go anywhere. But I love Italian wine, and I love French wine. I don't know. I like wine.
Okay. Art, domestically and abroad.
I've been reading a lot. Well, Charleston, I've never been, so talking about that, and I did some research before I came on the show. It does look pretty awesome just to eat at Husk. But also looking at all those, you know, top 10 lists that Charleston was on, LA seems to be up there, and it seems, I think it's always been good, but now it's getting like really great.
Yeah.
It, going back to like casual food as well, and like authentic ethnic food, seems like LA has a really awesome food scene that I've been reading about. So, and I've never been to Southern California before either. So,
and what about abroad? Cool.
Leon.
Leon,
sure.
Yeah.
Just watch that Anthony Bourdain episode when he goes to Leon. You'll just be like, oh my God.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. I've been to the Northern Rhone and didn't even get to Leon, which is like a sin.
That's another place on your list.
There you go. Meredith and Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Meredith.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to hear mostly, I guess, from the perspective of Derek and Art, what can we do as diners, and what can maybe the city do to help grow their business and kind of the word of mouth? Because we hear a lot coming out of just kind of being promoted. South Carolina obviously promotes Charleston quite a bit. I talk and brag about the restaurants that I enjoy, the cooks that I enjoy, the chefs I enjoy, the dishes. What more do they need from us? What more do they need from the city to help maybe grow this food scene? What's their perspective on that?
Guys, Derek?
That's a great question. I think from the city standpoint, you know, parking really is not the greatest thing in Rochester, but that's a whole nother case.
Other than that,
they're pretty supportive. You know, they have a lot of festivals. There's festivals every week in this town, I feel like, during the summer. So, and we all get invited to go participate in those. From a customer standpoint, I would say keep making those relationships with the people in the restaurants. Get to know your servers. Get to know your chefs. Take pictures. Post on social media. Instagram and Facebook, whether we want to admit it or not, is huge. And everybody's looking on there. Everybody wants to see what you're eating or what you're drinking or where you are. And I think that that's huge.
Art?
What can the city do?
Yeah, what the heck can the city
do? Like the government of the city?
What do you
like
mean, Meredith? Are you talking about diners or the government?
No, I mean, you see, even we talk about these lists, you see things that are paid for by South Carolina, paid for by Charleston, kind of advertising on the food scene's behalf, if you will.
It's a great question.
Yeah, I don't know how that works, but sure, we would love that kind of promotion from whoever sends out any of those publications, you know.
Could we see more tying things together?
Yeah. I think so. I don't see why Rochester couldn't do the same thing that Charleston, South Carolina does.
Well, let me just kind of get ready to wrap the program with a little story, because I think what I'm about to share is the kind of relationship that Derek is talking about. A friend of mine who knows more about food than I could ever know just went to Copenhagen, went to NOMA. And, you know, there are people who literally go from around the world, not for a weekend. They'll go there for one meal if they can get into NOMA. It's considered maybe the greatest restaurant in the world. And, you know, you're going to a place like this and you're always worried it's going to be a little stuffy. You know, people have gone to Per Se and some other joints in New York City, and you feel like, oh, how lucky are you to be here, and you better be worshiping, you know, our service, et cetera. At NOMA, he said, you arrived, everyone is so happy to be there, and the entire staff comes out and they just, it's like they're celebrating the arrival of these folks. From the owner of the restaurant, the chefs, everyone working on the line, just came out and made everyone feel so welcome. Like, oh my gosh, you came from around the world to be here? We've been waiting for you. How great to have you. And he said that just from the jump, a 22-course meal with just absolutely warm and welcoming, like they were, the diners were the celebrities.
That's awesome.
I thought it was just great. I thought the story was awesome because everybody can feel welcome in a setting like that. And I imagine those are the relationships you want to build here in Rochester.
For sure.
Yeah,
for sure. It's very important to, I always try to walk through the dining room, shake hands, kiss babies. You got to do it. And people like that, you know. And when I came back from Florida, I worked at Next Door and tastings. That was so cool because it's an open kitchen. People love that. And they love to interact with the chefs.
Same, Art.
Yeah, it is the hospitality business.
I imagine you know, and Derek, you probably already know and will know even more of your regulars. You probably have people every night who you know, right?
Yeah, sure, of course.
That's great to hear. Lento is open for dinner.
Yep, Tuesday through Saturday, and we're open for brunch on Sunday.
And brunch on Sunday. Unterbiergarten is open when?
We do lunch and dinner Tuesday through Saturday, and then Sunday brunch.
Wherever you're going this weekend, whether it's Unter or Lento, or Charleston, or Noma, or beyond. Hope you have a good dining experience. Hope you support local. Hope you support your public radio. Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We've had a wonderful summer of food, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.